This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Melissa Idris. I've got Ibrahim Saini and Sharad Kutan here with me. We are watching the final lap to the White House. And if you stay with us for the next 45 minutes, we'll be joined by a host of commentators in the US, including Karim Razlan, CEO of KRA Group, who's been in the US for the past couple of weeks. Sanjay Krishna will be joining us in about 15 minutes. He's the associate professor at Boston University. And Prashant Parameswaran, associate editor at The Diplomat. But first, let's take a quick update about what's the latest in the US. Ibrahim, what do you have so far?
Okay, so just to recap everything, they need 270 electoral votes to win. Right now, Trump has 19. That's 1-9. Clinton has 3. Vermont has called for Clinton for 3 electoral votes. Indiana has called for Trump for 11 electoral votes. And Kentucky, as we mentioned earlier, 8 electoral votes right there. The gubernatorial elections have... is still on the Indiana and New Hampshire results, with Republican governors actually scoring those two states.
Okay, we have Karim Razlan on the line from Michigan. He's been, as I mentioned, in the U.S. for a while now. Sharad?
Karim, could you tell us, I mean, how long exactly have you been and where have you been in the U.S. the last couple of weeks?
Gosh, I landed about a week ago in San Jose in the Bay Area. Then I was there for a few days, and I was in Houston, drove from Houston to Little Rock, and now I'm in Michigan. I was at Grand Rapids last night.
Well, sounds wonderful. Karim, the media is talking about this election as being a divisive. And is that something you sense on the ground? I mean, the people that you've spoken to, do you sense that there's been a high level of toxicity, a lack of enthusiasm for candidates? I mean, Republicans not being that excited by Trump, Democrats not so excited by Hillary. Is that true of what you sense in your travels?
I don't think so, actually. I was last night in Grand Rapids for the closing of the Trump campaign. And I queued patiently with thousands, and I must stress thousands of Americans, and 98% were white, or maybe 99%. So, and they were very enthusiastic, chanting, you know, lock her up periodically, along with drain the swamp. So I think in a way there's been a galvanizing of shall we say, the white community, which is and is really quite an experience to be the lone foreigner kind of standing there.
Okay, just to clarify, the lock-up is a reference to Hillary. I think Trump called her over and over again Crooked Hillary. And the swamp, I'm assuming, has got to do with Washington, D.C. and the establishment.
Yeah.
Is this a kind of anti-establishment passions that Trump has unleashed? And then where do you think it's going to go if, say, Trump does not win?
Well, I think, you know, essentially we have to go back. We've had two terms of Obama, who, let's not forget, is a black man. And America for many centuries has seen itself as a white Anglo polity. So for two terms, it has been run by a black man. So I think there's a residual resentment. And then Obama has been so brilliant at assembling this rainbow coalition of blacks, LGBT gays, women, Latinos, Asian Americans, all of those who were once excluded from power are now essentially in power. So I think in a way what we're seeing is a mobilization of white ethnicity and white identity. That's the only thing I could come away with, you know, and I spent 3-4 hours with them. It was quite disturbing, I must admit, but it was eye-opening.
Karim, have you spoken to members of the Republican Party? We know, of course, in the coming out of the last election, concerns that the post-mortem for the Republican Party said the Republican Party must in some ways embrace the Latino vote, especially that demographic is growing. We know because support for the Republican Party by Latinos has fallen year after year. And it seems like Trump completely ignored it. And now we have a talk of a Latino surge. Do you think the Republicans, you know, even as they galvanize the white around the idea of white identity, are kind of missing the plot?
Sharad, first off, the normal way that I operate with Tritalar is we hit the ground and we kind of listen to ordinary people's stories. So the last thing we do is actually go and talk to office holders, party politicians. We want to get a sense from the ground. So I've not spoken to any Republican, Democrat, party officials or campaign people or whatever. So my views come really from the ground, number one. I think number two, my gut feeling is this is about white identity and this is about kind of mobilizing the voice, because essentially you've got Latino communities mobilized, identified. I spent a lot of time with different Asian American communities, with Vietnamese, with Filipinos. I was just in Dearborn having a look at the Arab Muslim community there. You know, everyone else has a community, has an identity, but in a way the whites and the Anglos don't. Even, you know, women have an identity in the American polity. And I can't get away from this idea that this is somehow where it will go next. Of course, when whites band together and identify as such, it becomes something which is tinged by racism. But I have a feeling that that's what it's all about. That's my gut feeling, yeah? I haven't discussed with party political officials, as I said.
Karim, so what are, if you could kind of like crystallize it, what are the hopes or anxieties of this kind of emerging white identity politics?
Well, I think it's about exclusion. It's about this sense that, you know, they have, you know, is it a white male is just going to be the vice president going forward? And then with Hillary, you know, you're admittedly she's white, but she's, she is galvanizing the same groups again, yeah? When you speak to Latinos, you speak to Filipino, American, Vietnamese, generally the views are very strongly anti-Trump. So, you know, you get a situation where the vice president will be a gray-haired white male, whereas normally it would have been a gray-haired white male as the presidential candidate, yeah?
Do you think the 8 years of Obama has, in fact, paradoxically unleashed a deep-seated racism in America?
Yes, I think so. That's my gut feeling. I want to spend a bit more time. And when we hit Baltimore and Washington, we're going to spend some time with guys from the black community, young chaps in their 20s. Our cutoff period is age is about 35. But I have a feeling that's where it's going. You know, America's not my terrain. I'm just applying the standard kind of Tritalar approach. It's been very, very interesting. And also, to my concern really is that whatever happens, there will be, as you say, a very divisive and very nasty atmosphere at the top of the American politics. At the same time that over in Beijing, you have Xi Jinping consolidating power. And you have Americans kind of unable to concentrate. You know, and America is a very important superpower. If they can't concentrate, if they can't think about their alliances, their responsibilities and obligations around the world, then we have one superpower declining fast and another new one growing very fast. We like to have at least two superpowers to set them off against one another. That would be my view.
Karim, Melissa here. Now, I take it that you're probably going to be in the States even after the election results have come out. How do you see, you know, speaking to people on the ground, how do you see Americans mending the division that this campaign has caused upon the society?
Well, I think that's an elite issue, yeah? But I think on the ground, like I myself, you know, having spent so much time listening to minority views, I felt very, very wary about going to the Trump event. And, you know, and talking to white Americans now, I'm very wary, you know, could they be a Trump supporter? You know, and you have to kind of gauge and ask a few questions. So if I'm thinking like this and I've only been here a week, I wonder what it's like for people who really, you know, live and work here. You know, how do they gauge to what extent they can interact with someone else? Because, as you say, Trump has unleashed this venom and very racist views, which not dissimilar to what people like Boris Johnson did with English identity in Brexit in the UK.
What are American views? I mean, on the ground, ordinary Americans' views of government. I mean, I know around the world, in Malaysia in particular, we think of the government as having a leading role in society. We wouldn't want something like gridlock to happen. We know, along with the presidential elections, there's tough races in the Senate, and the composition of the Senate is going to be very important to how an American president, whether it's a Trump or a Hillary, actually operate. Do Americans think of this, of the presidency, of the executive, as being crucial to their lives?
I think not, because it was interesting when I was in California talking to kind of Asian Americans there, and those who were kind of getting involved in the political process, they said, hell, a lot of what we do and our lives, our governance, can be decided at the county level and at the state level. For example, there was an initiative in Santa Clara County, where San Jose is, to raise taxes, sales tax, so that they could spend $6 billion U.S. dollars on increasing and widening the toll, the roads, and the transportation system. So basically, there's a lot that is going on at county and state level, and so federal level is so far away for so many people. So as you're entirely right, it's a lot is going on at the local level. And a lot of the more heated debates are about local office holders.
Karim, before we let you go, we have to ask you, who do you think will be the next president of the United States?
I don't know. I must admit, I think if it's Trump, it will be a bit distressing. So I would have to plump with Hillary. But that's mostly wish fulfillment. Yeah, I think I'd like to see her being the president. Trump, give us all sleepless nights.
Thank you for speaking with us. That was Karim Razlan, CEO of Kiari Group, who's traveling in the US, speaking to people on the ground about their feelings and their thoughts of this elections. We'll keep you updated with the latest on the results as they trickle in. So make sure you stay with the Morning Run for the next half an hour. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill on The Morning Run. It's 8:18. We are looking to the U.S. in who will finally make it to the White House. It is D-Day for the U.S. In terms of the results. Well, let's cross over to the U.S. now. We've got Sanjay Krishnan on the line. He is the associate professor at Boston University.
Good morning, Sanjay. Well, rather, good evening.
Good evening to you, Sanjay. Yes.
It's been said that this election has been a cultural one, and I wonder if you can help us understand that. Have many of the debates been about values, American values, as opposed to policy?
Yes, some have characterized it as a cultural debate with two visions fighting for preeminence. On the one hand, there are those people who have been characterized as left behind by globalization and those who have done well out of globalization. So that would be one way of thinking about the cultural debate. What Trump has managed to do is, galvanize people who are associated with manufacturing, places that have kind of gone out of business. A lot of people have lost jobs, and has rallied them around a kind of ethnic identity. He has sort of put it to them that their loss has also to do with the loss of an older vision of America, which was predominantly white, culturally conservative. And that this older America is being threatened by immigration, by trade, by foreigners, and by globalization.
You have been, I know you're a native at Teluk Intan, you have been in the U.S. over many electoral cycles. Is the cultural dimension always there in the elections? Is it more pronounced now, do you think, than it's ever been in your experience of the last 20 years?
I would say so. you know, the last two elections have been quite extraordinary as well. I mean, you know, Barack Obama was the first black president to be elected in 2008, and then he was re-elected in 2012. So that was quite extraordinary. But the cultural divide there was slightly different from the one that we are experiencing today. I think that there it was much more about a new vision, a vision of hope, a new kind of America, which would be inclusive and pluralistic versus an older sort of idea of, you know, Republican ideology based on small government, big business and so forth. But in this election, it feels different. It feels different because society itself has been sort of mobilized to take sides on the kind of America they want to live in going forward, whether it's going to be an America that embraces multiculturalism or an America that sees multiculturalism as a threat to an older, ethnically homogenous white identity.
Also, you know, going in this elections, in the primaries, as it were, phase of this race, there was the Bernie Sanders phenomena. And he, you know, was doing very well with white voters, with young people, much more than, say, Hillary was. And there was a sense that Bernie Sanders and his movement or what momentum was really about some revolutionary impulse in America that, you know, that young people wanted some serious change happening. What's happened to that Bernie Sanders phenomena?
Well, I think that the Bernie Sanders represented a kind of an insurgent movement within the Democratic Party, even though Bernie Sanders is, you know, is an independent. And just as Trump represents an insurgent movement within the Republican Party. But the difference is that the Democratic Party has managed to unite around Hillary Clinton in a way that the Republican Party has not managed to unite around Donald Trump. So what Bernie Sanders has done, I think, is sort of played a supporting role, tried to sort of rally his supporters and bring them over to the Clinton camp to say that, well, you know, we are going to work with Hillary Clinton, get her elected. And when she's elected, we're going to hold her accountable to a more progressive agenda than the one that she has been associated with, which has typically at least been characterized as, you know, being friendly to Wall Street and so forth. So that's the Bernie Sanders position at this point, as I understand it.
What about the fact that Clinton, if she wins the White House, might contend with a Senate that is going to stymie whatever grand plans that the left of the party, the Bernie Sanders, the other side of the party that's pushing for that progressive agenda?
You know, that's a very interesting question. I have no idea. I'm not a political pundit. But I will say that. I think that the country is undergoing a crisis right now. So there needs to be something more dynamic from the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party gains control of the Senate, they should, for the sake of the country's stability going forward, seek to address some of the demands that are being made by different groups, both from the extreme left and the extreme right, to cobble together a more inclusive vision. So if the Senate continues to sort of behave in the ways that it has been behaving in the last, you know, many years, then it doesn't bode well. It doesn't bode well. So my assumption is that the Democratic Party has taken notice that this is a real problem that cannot be solved by business as usual. Although, you know, having said that, I have no idea what the Senate is going to be like.
Sanjay, you know, we are watching the Senate race as well. But, you know, for a Malaysian audience that's used to, homogenous, coherent political parties, that if they have tensions within them, split and break up and such. But America's two main parties, the Republicans and Democrats, are big tent parties. And this is a concept that perhaps is alien to us in Malaysia. They seem to be perhaps a little more nimble, and they can regenerate themselves. So the talk of Republicans, the Republican Party falling apart. What do you make of American political culture, this big tent idea with political parties?
Well, the first thing I would say about the situation today is the demographic situation. America is very soon going to be a country without a white majority, right? So some of what we are seeing with the Trump phenomenon has to do with a kind of a last gasp effort by a populist demagogue to sort of rally the masses, and he has basically managed to sort of put out a message that has sucked into this idea of ethnic nationalism, white nationalism, different groups, people who've been out of jobs, people who are, young and disenfranchised, unable to buy homes, see themselves losing jobs abroad, and so on and so forth. So in the Republican Party, that big tent idea has more or less collapsed with the Trump phenomenon. So there is a civil war going on. And it's unclear what the party is going to do, whether it's going to go further to the right by embracing this white nationalist identity, or if it's going to try to sort of move towards a more sort of sympathetic position towards ethnic minorities, particularly the Hispanics. Now, the Democratic Party, on the other hand, has managed to sort of pull things together more effectively, if only because Trump has been such a polarizing figure who's managed to alienate every ethnic group other than the white majority. But even so, within the white majority, there are many, many divides. So the Democratic Party is probably better positioned, I think, to sort of create something like a vision going forward at this point. Again, having said that, it all remains to be seen. Things are very, very uncertain at this point. I think the main agenda for the Democrats, divided as they are between the Bernie Sanders camp and the Hillary camp, is to sort of bring about a victory. After the victory takes place, I suspect there will be many, many arguments within the Democratic Party.
Sanjay, Trump seems to have already given his concession speech, and in part, at least we get a sense of what it might be if he loses. He said something like, "This has been a massive waste of my time and money." Do you think Trump will go away if he loses, that he will kind of step out of politics and no longer lead this, this kind of insurgent movement, as you put it?
No. My sense is that Trump has the genius of Trump is that he has created a space for extremist ideology within the political mainstream. This will be his lasting sort of contribution, and it's already poisoned the American public sphere. And whatever he does after this, will, I think, sort of express itself through more divisive rhetoric, through more extreme positions, because I think what we've seen is a kind of a position that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party would never have uttered in public. Trump was an outsider who came in, seized control of the political discourse. And now that, there's talk of him sort of going into business, maybe starting a new TV station or something. And he has already brought on board, ideologues, people associated with Breitbart and, other sort of right-wing extremist groups who have rallied around him. Even if they don't see him as a white nationalist in the way that they are, he has given them a kind of space in which it has become legitimized. It has become legitimate to say, I believe that America is a white country. This was not possible before.
Thank you so much. That was Sanjay Krishnan, Associate Professor at Boston University. Now, join us after the 8:30 News Bulletin as we speak to Prashant Parameswaran, Associate Editor at The Diplomat, on the foreign policy implications, whatever the outcome of the elections. BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run. This is an extended version of The Breakfast Grill as we continue speaking to commentators in the US on their analysis of what's happening with the results trickling in for the elections there. Prashant Parameswaran, Associate Editor at The Diplomat, is on the line with us. He's based in Washington, D.C. But first, Prashant is on the line. Prashant Parameswaran. Sharad, over to you.
Prashant, you've been in the U.S. for some time now. Just before we get into the question of foreign policy implications from a Trump or a Clinton presidency, could you tell us what your sense of what is happening on the ground? Do you see the possibility, as Donald Trump said, that he was going to be the Brexit president? He said, you know, the election day was going to be Brexit times 50. Well, he said 5, and then he said 50. Then he said it would be Brexit plus, plus, plus. Do you see a real upset happening today? Because the polls indicated that Hillary was ahead. Do you think they could be a Trump victory?
Yeah, I think Trump wants to definitely draw that analogy between him and Brexit because he wants to give the idea that he's part of more of a global movement. But I think that's a little bit misplaced. The fact is, you know, the commentators have been debating for a long time whether there's sort of a secret Trump vote that will show up towards the end of the election, that it's not been reflected in the polls. But the fact is, if you talk to Donald Trump voters, you know, I was in West Virginia just a few days ago, you know, none of them are, you know, secretly for Donald Trump. They're very public and very fierce supporters of Donald Trump. And, you know, you have to keep in mind also that most, the majority of votes in the United States have already been casted even before tonight in the election. And a lot of the trends that we're seeing coming out actually bode better for Hillary than they do Trump, including the surge of Latino voters that we're seeing, for example, as well as the fact that her ground game in terms of the big data, the fact that they're going around canvassing and making these calls out to individual voters is much more developed for Hillary's campaign than it is for Donald Trump. So if you see small margins for Hillary, even if they're projected, a lot of experts who look at these big data sort of trends point out that her lead could actually be significantly higher than what has been projected. So I think if you put all of those things together, even if there's going to be a surge of enthusiasm for Donald Trump in the next few hours, you're not going to see anything like what happened in Brexit. Also, keep in mind, in the case of Brexit, a lot of the commentary before the vote happened rested on the fact that even though there was going to be a divided vote, essentially the undecided voters for Brexit essentially would be for the decision coming out, would be against the decision coming out. So, and then people woke up the next day and found out that that was not the case. In the case of Clinton, a lot of the votes that have been casted already still put her in a pretty good position. And if you look at all the projections, there's only one or two outside scenarios where Donald Trump will be able to get above the 270 projected.
Okay, Prashant, you are based in Washington, D.C. This is, Trump famously refers to it as the swamp. How do the people, the denizens of the swamp, view the possibility of a Trump victory? You're there talking to people in the Beltway, you know, policymakers, lobbyists and such. What do they think?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of nervousness here. I think on the one hand, you have Hillary Clinton, who is, you know, the definition or as close as you can get to a Washington establishment figure. She has connections to people here inside the Beltway dating back decades to when her husband was president. And even compared to President Obama, she appears to like the views of the establishment in terms of foreign policy. But in the case of Donald Trump, a lot of folks here don't even know what to expect. In terms of what his foreign policy might be. He's questioned the very fundamental premises of U.S. foreign policy, including his commitment to alliances, free trade, even though that's been an issue on Hillary's perspective as well, and even the U.S. nuclear umbrella. So there's been a lot of nervousness about what a Trump presidency could mean.
Now, we also know that the scenario in the U.S. is a complicated one. We're not looking just at who occupies the White House, but the composition of the Senate. Now, let's just turn our attention to a Trump scenario. Some people, some commentators are saying that, you know, Trump might take the White House, but he could also take, you know, to take the Senate as well. Will that alignment necessarily mean that Trump can do anything he wants and that the Republican Party will go ahead, you know, dismantle trade deals and such? It's a much more complicated thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It definitely is. And I'm glad that you mentioned that point, because I think some folks follow the presidential election, but they don't follow a lot of the things that go on in the legislature. Even if Trump were to take the Senate and the Republicans have control of the House and they retain that, and he takes the presidency, if you look at the example of President Obama in his first term, I mean, he had full control of the Congress as well as the presidency. But the tendency for what happens when presidents have that in U.S. history recently is that they tend to overreach and they do a little too much. And what you see in the next election is that there's going to be a corrective, or even the next midterms in the case of several presidents before. So it's not necessarily the case that Trump will be able to do whatever he wants to do. That being said, you have to look at specific cases, right? So one of the interesting cases is the case of the Supreme Court. And Trump has a long list of nominees that he's already said that he wants to appoint. And if he has control in the Senate, that gives the Republicans a chance to push through whatever candidate that Donald Trump wants.
And this is because it's going to have implications for the next several decades on issues that are kind of core to the debates around American values, whether it's civil union or it's abortion rights or and such. Do you see that as being the real game in this particular race?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that this is an important issue. It's not just about the issues in question or the presidency. It's about the role of the Supreme Court as an institution in American politics. You've seen a lot of Republicans come out in the last few weeks and say, we can just choose to, you know, keep that. If Hillary Clinton wins the presidency, we're just going to keep denying any nominee that she puts up. Essentially, that means that you don't have a complete Supreme Court and you won't have it for a number of years. And that's a very dangerous thing for American politics. But in terms of the political dimension of this, Donald Trump has been trying to use the Supreme Court vacancy as a way to galvanize traditional Republicans who he's found hard to get on his side. So there is an important academic long-term sort of policy implication in terms of the role of the Supreme Court, but there's also it being used as a political device to rally supporters, particularly on the Republican side, by Donald Trump.
Turn very quickly to, one of the centerpieces of the Obama administration, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, lauded in Malaysia and seen around the world as a good move. Do you think that either candidate will kind of refashion that in some ways? I mean, both Hillary and Trump seem to have no love for the TPP. Where do you think that goes, and how will countries around the world, especially the 11 other members of the TPP, react?
Yeah, I think, given the climate of populism in the United States, and as you pointed out earlier on the show, I mean, the fact that on the Democrat side, you've had Bernie Sanders come in as well, who opposed the TPP, both parties will find it very hard, irrespective of who is elected, to advance the TPP. That being said, I mean, there is a difference between the two of them. I mean, Donald Trump has said that within his first 100 days, he's going to call for the United States to withdraw from the TPP. Hillary Clinton, her advisors have said privately, and some of them have come out publicly and then later clarified their statements, she's going to try to find a way to pass TPP with a couple of adjustments sometime during her term. She may not do it immediately. She may choose to do it after the midterms in 2018. She may make some changes. She may attach a certain package and do a couple of side letters to win over certain congressmen. But there is a commitment among her and her team to try to potentially pass it in some form or another. Because if you read what her rhetoric says, I mean, she's opposed to the TPP in its current form, which means that she's left room open for herself to amend it if she needs to.
Prashant, last question for you. Are you a betting man? Who are you placing your bets on today?
Yeah, I think it's really hard at this stage to see a Donald Trump victory. I think what you're going to see is Hillary Clinton win. And, you know, it might not be as comfortable as some people predicted 4 or 5 or 6 months ago or even at the outset of the election. But I think the thing to watch will be the Senate, and I think the Democrats will narrowly take it. That will have significant implications for U.S. politics for years to come.
Thank you so much. That was Prashant Parameswaran, Associate Editor at The Diplomat, talking about the foreign policy implications for the outcome of the U.S. presidential elections. We'll keep you updated on the latest results coming in. But after this, we'll take a look at corporate business news. Stay tuned on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.